show me your calculations. So I did. He finally had to agree I was right, so I figured I'm not going to last very long in this department. I stayed the boss, you know.
Yes. Yes.
He was R.R. Williams' son-in-law. R.R. Williams was the guy who synthesized vitamin B1. Mm. Those are great days, I tell you. But you imagine turning something down and it turned out to be penicillin?
That's quite something.
There was a bunch of biochemists at Rutgers University at that time who we could have gone to. They did much of the early development work.
Yeah. And tell me about R.M. Burns, if you would. And can you just talk about him?
Well, I had very little contact with him except in the hiring stage. Harvey Neville says, why don't you hire this young man if you want to replace him? We'll find somebody else to take his place out here on the faculty. And then I came in and he assigned me to go out and work at Summit, New Jersey, which was 30 miles out. And I lost touch with R.M. Burns. The next time I got involved with him was I met him at a dinner. This was a dinner in 1946 at the Waldorf Astoria, where the Chemical Engineering Achievement Award dinner went to the Atom Bomb Project. He was at table 32 with me. In fact, we met at his house ahead of time, and here's a copy of Burns. He's at table 32.
Yes.
And here was I, table 32.
See? Okay, then this is the
Engineering Achievement Award dinner to the Atom Bomb Project in
1946. The other guy at table 32 was Bill Shockley. At that time he had invented the transistor. And this is very well done, by the way, for a historian-type person here. I've dragged that around from one house to another in a little old box, you know. And it gives a good review of the program, the whole thing. This and all the people who are involved in it.
Yes, I must say, I don't know if you've given any thought to the eventual disposition of chemical mementos like that, but we would certainly cut up them.
Okay, well, that's a good thought. Otherwise, you throw it out, you know?
Yeah, well, our business is, among other things, to physically conserve these evocative pieces of the chemical heritage. Yeah. Because
I tell you, it's such a throbbing organization that it keeps changing, you know? It's like, you know, that was the Hydra. You cut an arm off and it grows another one, you know, somewhere else.
Oh, yes.
And people get stuck on the arms that get cut off, you know, by staying with them instead of moving with the whole thing. You know? I was in a privileged position. I didn't have any established history in any one area. I could move around and do what I wanted to do and then move again to another area.
Yes, yeah. Well, you
that was the thing. That was my thing.
Well, you exploited your liberty very wonderfully.
You see, in Europe, my father's family divided into two groups. One group's in Siena, and they're all physicians. Mm-hmm. In fact, I went down a country road there one time at the top, and I saw the back of a bust. I went around looking in front with my name, exactly. Frank Joseph Hill. He was the chief surgeon of the local hospital, member of the faculty of the school, and he was looking down his valley. He was buried on top of a hill you could see for 40 miles on a clear day, and lots of clear days there. And the other part of the family is up around Pisa and Lucca.
Mm-hmm.
And they're in the electrical business, electrical engineering. My father was the oddball, and he wanted to study music. And he came over here because he found out that there was more music sold in the Lehigh Valley of Pennsylvania than any other part of the world. Sheet music.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't last very long because he found out that music teachers in this country aren't paid very well. So he went to Penn State. He got a degree in mechanical engineering.
Hmm.
He brought his brother over. He got electrical engineering. And then here is the... This is the wine down around Siena, beyond Isanti.
Oh,
this sells for $150 a liter.
Mm-hmm.
10 years old before it's bottled. It's a Brunello. And when the president of Italy went to England, he had the queen over to the embassy for a dinner, and this is the wine he took.
So,
I have that menu. Would you believe that?
Yes, yeah. Yes.
And, we had five or six bottles of this, and this is from the New York Times here.
This is in 21 February 85, talking about while Biondi Santi is unquestionably the greatest name in Brunello's. Boy. So it, you really missed your vocation.
You should have stayed there, right? Here are the prices here. From New York Times, May 1, 1994. Brunello di Montalcino.
Biondi Santi, $99 for what is that? Is that for a, what's that for? For a bottle?
That's for a liter.
For a liter?
Yeah.
Right, yes. Okay.
Beautiful.
So that's really the where the family comes from in its deeper origins.
Yeah.
Yes.
We had four bottles.
Mm.
1972, I think that was. Yeah.
Mm. Well, how do you see?
I'm sorry to be so disconnected here, but
this is just fine. This is just fine. How do you see the if you gaze into the crystal ball of the future, is the transistor type, the solid state type activity, is there going to be lots and lots more of that will be still under the electrochemical heading?
Yeah, it's very difficult to predict because, as I say, they're getting rid of aqueous processing acids, alkalis, because first of all, there are problems with people, there are problems with the atmosphere. They're going more and more towards working inside of glass chambers with ionized materials, which where you know you can make a pound do or a ton would do with the aqueous materials. That's the way they're going to go. And it's clean. You can clean it. You can check it out before you use it. Clean air. Cleans. As a matter of fact, one simple thing that I did to one factory day in Cruz, one of the West African factories, was I put a wall up. And everything that was delivered to that building, and that was one wall of it, was on the outside. That's where they brought in the carboys and they connected them up and all that. Before they bring them into the room where they made these things, with all the dirt.
Yeah.
And put all that outside, you put it in a pipe. And even the furnace, when the furnaces would burn up, and you had to take them out with all the insulation, I backed them up against the wall, had doors in the wall with tracks. You just roll them out, close the door, and it's fixed out there. When it's fixed, open the door and bring it back in again. Mm-hmm. It makes just common sense, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
The automobiles are done the same way. They work on an automobile.
Yes.
You take it to where the equipment is, you know?
Yes.
You don't repair an automobile in the front, in the parlor. That's what we were doing. You were repairing ovens in the parlor.
Yes.
And you're surprised that people wouldn't, you know, it takes money to do this, I'll admit. So I put up, in this new building at Murray Hill that they put up, I remember that they hadn't quite approved all the plans, but I got word of the plan that we were going to be on the fifth floor. And I went to the vice president who was in charge of the work that I was doing, a guy named Jack Morton, who was a character, I'll tell you. He fired me 3 times. but called me up 2 days later to apologize, you know. We didn't agree on certain things, you know. Like, well, anyway, I had called Jack up one day and said, Jack, you're the guy committed space. I'm going to be on the fifth floor with all my labs. Yep. I'd like to come up and talk to you about it. Okay, how about right now? That's the kind of guy he was, right now. And I said, Jack, the average height of these floor to ceiling here is 10 feet. I'd like to have the fifth floor be 14 feet. What the hell do you want that for? I told him, I want to build clean rooms up there, and I want to have a floor that comes up 2 to 3 feet with all the wiring underneath. And I want special walls on the outside where all the stuff comes in, the dirty stuff. And I want a special ceiling, and I want to put in HEPA filtered air. It didn't take him 5 minutes. Good idea. And I knew what a competitive guy he was. He wasn't going to agree just that fast. And I said, now you're going to have the cleanest room in the Bell system. Oh, this is better than Allentown has. Mm-hmm. Where his competitors had the manufacturing. You had to etch them on. Bought it right then and there. The builder was fit to be tied. He had all his plans. Because there was 2 floors above it. He had to move the whole thing up. We finally did that. And later on, they were complaining that this was a gold-plated outfit. You know, nobody could get in it. We didn't allow visitors. This is not a place for visitors to go in. They could look through the glass. They wanted to go inside, they had to get my personal signature, and they had to get dressed for it. You know. And they thought we had a gold-plated outfit. And I said, we have to have gold-plated treatment in order to make platinum-treated parts. You know. And by that, that's how we got reliability. We didn't change anything in a solid. We changed it in the atmosphere around it.
Yes.
Got rid of the sodium ions, for example. Got rid of the dust particles. Mm. Made a big deal. That particular little tube that was used in the towers, microwave towers, they had a flat cathode, like a pill, and they had a grid over it, tungsten wire, 0.7 mil above it. That wire was so tiny that it broke at 14 grams. So we had to wind that on a machine on a piece of tungsten with a hole in it, a flat sheet with a hole in it.
Mm-hmm.
So the machine, the wire was up there one time, then it went down there. And we had to do it without breaking that 14 mil. 14, did I say mil? 14 milligrams.
Yeah.
Wait.
Yeah.
Very tight. And that was 0.7 mil away. And then above that was the anode. And the whole thing could be plugged in. You put a plug on it. It'll plug from one side for the other, you see. But that made possible coast-to-coast television, too.
Mm.
We originally did it for coast-to-coast communications,
mm-hmm.
not television.
Yes.
Then, you know, we put up the first satellite before the U.S. government got one up. We had Telstar 1 went up.
Yes.
Nobody in it.
Yeah.
And it only lasted 4 days because 3 days after it went up, the Army exploded an atom bomb right in the path of the damn thing. Not that they were trying to destroy it. They had planned that, but they didn't tell anybody. Would you believe that? After all that work, private satellite, we lost it. They creamed our, what it did was they creamed all the semiconductors. So that, we said we got a new challenge. We got to develop semiconductors that will stand that kind of, and we did. So the present satellites come take advantage of that information. Now, just where the, no question in my mind that the electrochemical society played a key role at a time when it was necessary to play that particular card, and they provided this. What happened to it? I'm sorry to say I can't tell, because I didn't stay with it.
Yeah.
Not because I wasn't interested, because I had other things to do.
Yeah.
I went on patch here, and patch there, and patch somewhere else. And the whole thing worked, you see.
Yes. Oh, yes. Well, you did. You were a key benefactor.
That's right. That's right. I didn't drop that atom bomb. In fact, I was surprised they dropped the damn thing. I thought they were tested in a more humane way. But, you know, they had Harry Truman down there, who was a tough old bird.
Yeah.
And we had a bunch of tough guys in the Army Air Corps who wanted, they said, you know, million of ours versus this atom bomb, million of theirs, you know. They won't understand it. And they didn't understand it even after it was dropped, you know. They thought they could sweat it out, you know.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
Tremendous business. Boy, that business about the atom bomb. We bring guys in, you know. Norway was occupied by the Germans, and Sweden was not. Norway and what's the other?
Denmark.
Denmark. We wanted to bring in a professor from Denmark. You know, we got the ROSS people went in, took him out, put him on a plane, brought him over to New York. We talked to him for 4 hours, put him back on a plane, sent him back, and reinserted him. They would do that all the time. They said, no problem. You would see him, just let us know.
Hmm.
I still remember that name.
That was in connection with the atom bomb?
That's right, yeah. Hmm. We could only talk to him in one room that our Secret Service people had checked out. Wasn't bugged, they said, no, you know. Because we had so much trouble with the Japanese after the war coming over here. Although we were taking pictures of everything, we had a room, we'd take them through, that would fog all the pictures. They never complained. They either understood why and said, oh, well, okay, makes sense. We was trying to steal your idea and you know how to protect yourself. They never said a word, to my knowledge.
Yes, yes, yes. How have the the changes with AT&T and since 84 and now this new thing, how have they affected the Bell Labs' role and capability in these areas?
Well, they're back to where they were in 1926 when they put it all together. That's when they had AT&T was running mostly the telephone companies. All the operating companies, they were the headmaster of all those people. And they owned the Western Electric Company, who was a manufacturer. And they decided to put them together. And I told you, with some of the hard times we had to wait for a generation of people to retire before that became smooth, because the old flags were still flying, you know. Now they're back to where they were again. AT&T is running. They don't run the telephone companies anymore because they haven't got them. They run the long distance telephone system. They're not going to be allowed by law to get into the local into the same local service. That's going to take 10 years, but they'll get into it. And they're also going to get into cable TV, anything they can get into now. And They're going to start an AT&T laboratory. And to do that, they took about 50% of the old Bell laboratories. The other 50% they left behind, they still call the Bell Laboratories. It works now for the organization, which is used to be Western Electric, which makes switching equipment. and all kinds of things. You see, the baby Bills wouldn't buy switching equipment from the old Western Electric Company after they were separated, because they knew that AT&T was going to be their competitor. Why should they buy and make a profit for their competitor? So now, by even changing the name to Lucent, there's no hint of Bell System involved in that second company.
Yeah.
I think it'll flourish.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Because
mm-hmm.
all these other companies start buying switching equipment from the Canadians or from the Germans, because they didn't want to give a profit to AT&T, and AT&T's profits from switching equipment was going downhill. These are big, that's what these things were developed for, these big cards.
Yes, yes.
And there's gold-plated contacts on the edge of that. That's very important. There was a lot of problem with that. That whole switching system, which can handle something like 500,000 calls during a busy hour, works on the basis of all the circuitry being plugged in. Everything goes through those gold-plated prongs at the end,
mm-hmm.
here and there. And that thing checks itself out every 3 minutes and tells the operators what's wrong and what to do about it. Self-diagnose, part of the system. And all that equipment is all based on circuit boards, glass circuit boards, or copper circuit boards with something with seven layers, where you go down to layer two to get power, and up to layer three to get conductivity this way or that way. Mm-hmm. And that's called the Electronic Switching System, ESS. That was developed 20 years ago now. Yeah, maybe 25. I was involved in that, in the gold plating end of it, because they were saying, God, all these beautiful circuits we have, if the connectors don't work, we've lost the whole thing.
Yeah.
You got to be able to pull them out and shove another one in. And it's working. And it was the premier switch anywhere in the world. They licensed people to make them. They've licensed the Chinese to make them. I presume they're going to get some money from the license, but not a very profitable thing. But I think the Electrochemical Society is going to continue to have a role in the electronics business. I think, like any society or any organization, it ought to be smart enough to look out in the new areas. I mentioned some of them here very briefly. I don't know if anybody's doing anything about it. I don't read anything about it anywhere.
The new areas like
corrosion resistance.
Yes.
No, there's utterly billions and billions of rusting away bridges. Sidewalks. Down in Philadelphia, there was a bridge put in on a Schuylkill Parkway, isn't it? Is that what it's called? And it would last 2 years because the steel rods in them began to corrode. Some or other,
yes,
water got in, cracks or something, and salt from the,
yes,
you know, for the ice. Now, you know, a little generator, it's used on pipelines.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. In fact, some of the gas pipelines take gas out of the pipelines to generate power with some thermocouples. You know, dissimilar metals, you warm them up, yeah, a little bit, you generate current. Yeah. And a bird on there. Sorry. I'm following a bird who's emptying his bowels on our driveway. I'm trying to find out where the hell he lives. I think he's in there. Anyway, that would be a tremendous area to work on. I don't know why there isn't more attention paid to that.
Yes. The Electrochemical Society seems to have been unusual, perhaps, or in having being very open to all these applied
really? Areas and issues. And
how about cross bleeding with or blending with the American Chemical Society? Does Electrochemical Society get involved in them? No joint meetings?
No, they've really kept themselves pretty pretty distinct. Some of the same people turn up wearing a different hat.
Sure. As you know, there's all kind. There are societies that deal with a phenomenon only, or with a material only, or a process only, way down at the bottom. And you have specialists in that area. Then at the other end, you have the monoliths, like IEEE and American Chemical Society.
Yeah.
You know, deal with everything. If you go to a meeting, you get lost in the mush.
Yeah.
Tremendous. And then in between, there's all kind of gradations. And some of these societies maybe no longer have any real reason to take the spot they had 20 years ago. They don't longer have it. They're not entitled to it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Techniques moves along. Something moves along. Mm. That's the danger when you work on something that is helpful to the electronics industry, which moves all the time.
Yes. Yes.
See?
Yeah,
that's the price you have to pay. You'll be left behind them, either because you're obsolete, or maybe you lost interest, or maybe it's in the new activities involve techniques or science that is way away from your province.
Hmm. Yeah. Well, the Electrochemical Society seems to have stayed with it.
How is its members showing? Is it increasing, holding its own?
It's holding its own. It's been increasing, I think, with overseas membership, and that globalization phenomenon is what's happening, I think.
Yeah.
And I think the society thinks of you as one of its benefactors for bringing the.
Well, let me say honestly, yeah. I didn't do this with the idea in mind that I like this society, I'm going to help them. They were in a position they could help me.
Yeah.
I needed an outlet for my people to publish their work, and I couldn't find it. It was going to be scattered. Mm. It was going to be published in 8 different places, which is even worse.
Yes.
So I thought if I could centralize it in one place, for most of the people, you can't guarantee this thing. After all, I was not a dictator. I couldn't say you have to publish there. I got most of them to do that. You know, I didn't have to take much pressure to do that.
Yeah.
But this must have, you know, there must be dozens of guys around like me that worked on these other societies, you know.
Mm-hmm. Well,
I don't know who they are. They don't know who I am, you see.
Yeah.
We meet in the middle.
Yes. Yeah. Well, you were the one who made this thing stick. So.
Well, yeah.
Thank
you
for that.
I throw the crystallized it by throwing something into the and then went away, and whoever took it over and kept it running did a job.
Well, you scratched the test tube.
The ASTM is still in existence.
Oh yes, right.
But there are other societies around that are doing the same sorts of things.
Yes, there's competition.
And they had such an antiquated structure, you know. They were worried about glass windows and railroad tracks and big industry items like that, you know, and pipes. Well, every time I pick up a polyvinyl chloride pipe around here in my irrigation system, it says ASTM on it. So-and-so, committee so-and-so. Believe it. I picked a piece up yesterday. I just looked at it. She is. She's still operating.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, no, they're still very much in business.
But I used to go to some of the meetings of their board and on Saturdays, so it wouldn't cut into my work week, especially in the wintertime when I didn't have to work. It didn't have baseball considerations and things like that. And I didn't even know what they were talking about, you know. There little problems come up that are different in each area of specialization. You have to have a history of that to understand what the problem was.
Yeah.
And nobody stopped to say, look, there's a new man in the room. They better say, you know, X years ago we were doing this and so on, this and this happened, and now we're doing it this way, and we're having a problem here. That's where we are today. Then they go on, I understand. They never did that. I didn't expect them to do it. I was sort of hanging on, trying to understand it. In fact, I did put a man on our board. I found a man who was interested in that kind of thing. Got him on our board. He turned out later to be a vice president of AT&T. I lost track of the guy.
Hmm. Well, you've had a good talent for surviving winners.
He was a guy when he was the vice president of Western Electric Company for you. Saw a tremendous growth about to occur, and we had to go out and buy property in 8 or 10 states, you know, Alabama, Wisconsin, Washington, for a future plan. In fact, start to work on the one in Los Angeles. Then the bottom fell out of the market. We were stuck with all these properties. In some cases, we had half-finished buildings. Boy, was he wrong. You know, we didn't have that growth. You know, they were talking 7 or 8% a year, which is fantastic. You know, we're 1.5% now.
Yes.
Fantastic. And then he also did some smart things. Anytime we wanted to start anything new, we had to do an analysis of the break-even point. How much would it cost us to get into this business? How long would it take? And what would we get out of it? For example, when I got involved in batteries, the Bell system, you know, the operating companies work on DC. I don't know if you know that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. They buy AC, rectify it, and then trickle charge batteries, and then operate the plant off batteries. This gives them, in case there's a drop off of the AC, they can operate for, depending on how many hours a place is designed for, anywhere from 1 to 14, 15 hours. Or some plants put in a diesel engine in addition to run an alternator, which then is rectified. Well, we were having trouble buying batteries that we could depend on. They became vintage things. Batteries made in a certain year, in a certain plant, on the second shift, but not the third shift, were better than those made on the first shift. It was terrible. One battery went bad, you couldn't put a new battery in on the whole string. You know, place was terrible. And we found out all we knew about batteries, big batteries, was what the battery companies told us. And I said to my boss, why are we believing these guys? They don't have any evidence that they understand this thing. Why don't we take that understanding over? We'll run our own show. We'll design our own battery. He says, come on. That battery business is in there. Been in Dennis for 100 years. You're going to beat them up? I says, I think we can get a better battery out of it if we design it ourselves. Forget about these guys. We sat down, closed the door one day, up to the book, problem number one. We decided we'd put modern science into every aspect of it. All right, we're going to use lead. Why don't they use lead? Because it expands as it oxidizes. And the guts, which gives the electrochemical activity, falls out. So that's because they use lead alloys. And why do they use lead alloys, lead anode? Because lead is too soft. If you make it vertical, it flows like butter, but at a much slower rate. It takes years. But it flows enough that these little fillings drop out of the holes in it. They're actually square holes. So we said, well, we'll use pure lead. Well, avoid that. How do you do that? Well, you got to lay it flat. Well, you can't lay it flat. So we decided to lay it at 10 degrees, and we built a stack of pancakes at 10 degrees. We put a hole up the middle so we could pump the sulfuric acid around. Otherwise, it would stabilize. It would have a gravity much different down here than it had up here. And these are big cells, you know, they're that tall. same things used as submarines. We helped the Navy design their submarines so many, many years ago. Anyway, so we started on that premise, and we were able to go out in the field and take batteries that were, for some reason, 20 years old. They had lasted. Surprising. Brought them in, took them apart, and found out how did they look like when they were 20 years old? And why didn't they expand? So we decided to make a tester up. Well, in the long run, before we knew it, in 2 years, we were able to take a new idea and put it in a test battery and get 20 years of experience in 2 years. So we had a handle. We could then make changes, put it through this test, and we redesigned these cells. They're called the round cells now. And then our manager said, we're not in the battery business. We're going to take this out and have the battery people make them. I said, you mean these old guys that gave us these lousy batteries, you're going to let them make our battery? Come on. Don't believe you. And he said, well, you can't make that battery that you're talking about unless you have guys in white coats and PhDs. I said, I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll rent some space from our junkyard. We had a junkyard in Staten Island. What the hell was he called? Well, anyway, doesn't matter. I went down and rented some space from them and put up, they had earthen floors in this building. She was how old it is. I put a building up inside the plant for their offices, and we made the batteries outside, and we put them into this test that we had, and then we put them in a one exchange, and finally he was convinced, hell, if you can build them down there in the junkyard on an earthen floor, these battery guys can't be so bad. He was still wrong. We had to nurse these battery guys. We had to pay them to make our batteries because of his idea. And it turned out, 20 years later, that battery that we're selling all over the world is making more money for AT&T than the transistor business. Would you believe that?
Boy.
Beautiful. I had an exhibit on it then to throw them all out because they were big plates, you know. Mm. In fact, the guys made me a lamp with an old battery.
Mm.
You know, my wife said, that's out, you know. Couldn't bring her in the house. But, you know, that led never. See, in the meantime, we had a fallout of this thing. Bill Campbell, this fellow who was sitting at the table with us at the Adam Baum Award, which I chose to sit on my committee on fuel cells, he was working, instead of a lead antimony, which causes all this water to be gassed into hydrogen and oxygen, and therefore you have to add water all the time. He used another, and that was put in there to try to make the lead stronger, more brittle, not flow, but it was based on an up and down like a sheet. See, what was it? He added another item to it, which resulted in the no maintenance battery, because it didn't break down water into hydrogen and oxygen. Mm-hmm. And that was the whole industry had. You know that not a single company came to us to buy a license to use that. And the day the patent expired, J.C. Penney called us. Somewhere around the country, they sell batteries in our stores. They wanted to buy know-how, not a license to use a patent to the patent that expired, but how much was the know-how going to cost? So they could use this lead with a vertical plate, but with a new element in it to make it strong, which did not hydrolyze water. At the same time, on the one end, this guy was working to make it a better battery using the old technique. We were working on the other end with a flat plate, relatively flat, 10 degrees. And the idea of the chimney effect, there were different gravities at the top, there was at the bottom, and they tended to equalize it that way. You know, we had 18 different batteries, depending on where you went, to measure the concentration of the sulfuric acid and or its temperature, you see? Mm-hmm. And we didn't use any burning. Lead is traditionally burned with a flame. All the lead-to-lead contacts are made by diffusion. What you do, you put the two clean parts, you put them together, and you put an RF field around it to heat the part slowly. And by diffusing, there's no oxygen in the part, mm-hmm. no oxidized parts. That's where the corrosion used to occur.
Yes.
Spectrochemistry, you see?
Very good.
Yeah. Very the battery good. Business, that's always going to be with us as a battery.
Yes, business. Oh yes.
And I don't know where the guys who were working on the battery business got involved with a committee of the IEEE, which was standardizing batteries. So that's where their outlet was. I got involved mm-hmm. in that thing,
mm-hmm.
you see.
Mm-hmm.
And it's still involved. Then we decided to start a new society called the Power Society. It deals with power of all sorts, from, you know, microwatts to megawatts, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And that's still running, and one of my guys is still involved in that. He calls me up every now and then. He sends me programs, and I said, I'm not going to your meetings. I wouldn't understand what you're talking about. It's a waste of my time. You know, that's I've been out. I've been retired now 12 years or so, yeah. When I left Bell Labs, I became a consultant, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I found I was solving the same problems I'd solved 10 years earlier in the outside industry. And I was amazed at the lack of honesty in most American corporations. They were thieves. They were buying information. They were hiring people only if they brought with them all the information from the former job, including blueprints, specifications. And those working for the government were worse. I was asked to consult on some jobs where they were building connectors. I became an expert in the connector business. It's because I knew something about gold. And I inspired, I couldn't inspire an American company, I inspired a Japanese company to build a piece of equipment you put at the end of a plating line, which measured the plating rate in each cell of a plating line. And if the plating rate had dropped for some reason, it increased it in that cell, or it was too high, it decreased it. And then it tested 100% of the product as it came out. Here they could tell a customer that 100% of what you're buying had been tested. And we know it hadn't got holes in it to corrode to the base. It has low contact resistance because you got the amount of gold there that you want to be there. Not at any American company. I went over to Japan, spent 3 days over there, represent an American company. The only way I could get to these Japanese companies is I had to become a consultant to these Japanese companies for 3 days. And they gave me Japanese printing card, mm-hmm. name mm-hmm. cards. They took me around to all their places. They had an interpreter with me. They had a chauffeur who couldn't speak English, hauled me all around, mostly around Tokyo. And it was a very successful operation. The company who bought it, who I was consulting with, fired the guy I was working with. Because he was the guy, for all these years, had been telling how good it was. When he bought this equipment from the Japanese, they found out how bad the problem was. He was shipping out. He was shipping out two or three times the thickness of gold that he needed to.
Boy.
Because he was afraid it was too thin, he had reports. This machine measured it, you see, to a micron.
Yeah.
You're supposed to put on so many microns of gold. He was putting on double or triple. And when he found out this machine, the cost of the gold each month dropped to a third, they fired him.
Yeah.
That's one of my problems. Is one company I worked for, three vice presidents were discharged because I was put on a job to find out what was wrong with their program, and I found out. Do you believe that? I won't tell you the company name because it's a well-respected company. Yeah. Well-respected company. People were afraid to talk to me.
I could imagine.
Yeah. Because I got the reputation, don't talk to that guy, you're going to get you fired. Then, yeah, that didn't happen in Bell Labs, you see.
Yeah. Yeah.
You go, and this is a very respected company, still in business today, making a lot of money. One of the companies out in Long Island was building a connector for a circuit that was going into an Air Corps fighter. When these young kids go up, you know, they crash half of them, you know. And I could understand if they depended on the stuff they put in was 30 years old, these connectors. And they had no... what they did was 30 years earlier in some airplane they were making 30 years ago, they proved that that connector was working properly. That's the way the Air Force works. And they certify you as a supplier of that. You're certified. Every now and then they'll send an inspector around to see if you haven't changed anything. That doesn't happen very often. And what's happening is the 30-year-old product is getting worse and worse because the guy who's manufacturing it is no interested in it. He's got 5 new products, but he can't change because if you do that, they've got to recertify that.
Yeah.
And that takes 2 years. And for 2 years, you can't sell anything to the government. So they don't want to recertify. So they called me out to this place, Long Island, want to know whether I would work with them to solve their problem so they didn't have to recertify it. They would make some changes. I said, you know you can't do that. That's illegal. And you shouldn't be asking me to do something illegal. I said, just that, and my bill is going to be 3 times my normal rate. And they paid it. And I said, look, if anything comes up here, I have my own records. You can't sue me, you know, because I didn't do it. Help you avoid the law, you know. Terrible with these people, hombre.
Mm.
I had a guy who was plating, this electrochemist, he was plating platinum on a contact that, again, was going to a government agency. And the chief engineer was a bookkeeper. He called me up one day because I had helped him. He ran out of gas on a highway in New Jersey, and I stopped, helped him out get some gas, he introduced himself, and I told him I was working for Bell Labs and all that. He called me up one day after I had retired. He said, oh, he didn't hear anymore, but they gave him my number. Called me up and says, we're having a problem. The platinum on our connectors is corroding. So, wait a minute, platinum doesn't corrode. I better keep quiet about this so I find out what's going on. So I'm allowed to visit this plant in suburban New Jersey. And I found out, by God, he was getting corrosion. Couldn't believe it. So I said, look, you got to give me a carte blanche and go anywhere I want around here. I'm going to find out what the hell's going on or I'm not going to help you. Okay, got carte blanche.